More missiles fired into space, more Iranian saber-rattling on the eve of negotiations.
Last month, at the behest of the Vulcan ambassador, I opened a dialogue with Gorkon, Chancellor of the Klingon High Council. He proposes to commence negotiations at once.
Negotiations for what?
An end to almost 70 years of unremitting hostility, which the Klingons can no longer afford.
To offer Klingons safe haven within Federation space is suicide.
Sir.
Captain Kirk.
The Klingons have never been trustworthy. This is a terrifying idea.
The idea of Iranian nukes meets the practical goal of reestablishing a dialogue with Iran. Is the United States dealing with Klingons or a former Middle East ally?
This is a terrifying idea.
Settle down, Captain Kirk. Phasers on stun. Countdown to Geneva on The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Celeste Headlee from WNYC and PRI.
Good morning, everyone. Tuesday, September 29th. I'm John Hockenberry here with Celeste Headlee.
Good morning, John. This hour, some of the relief efforts that are heading towards the Philippines to relieve those who are victims of the flood there. Also, somehow, Takeaway sports guru Ibrahim Abdul-Mateen is going to make a connection between the Dallas Cowboys and Lord of the Rings. We'll see how that works out and what some bosses are doing to make sure workers don't get burnt out.
But first, let's get a response from Rudy Bakhtiar. She's Director of Public Relations for the Public Affairs Alliance of Iranian Americans. Rudy, excuse me for using the Star Wars Trek Klingon or Star Trek Klingon reference here, but you know, do the U.S. and Iran have as much trouble understanding each other sometimes as characters in a Star Trek movie?
You know, when you brought that up, it reminded me of an actual fact that actually Kuhn created those Klingons as an allegory to the Cold War tensions back then between the United States and Russia. So it's funny that you bring that up. But I'd like to say that maybe that was the case before the June elections. But I think since then, the Iranian people have shown what it is that's on their mind and that they actually differ from the government and what they would like to see for the country. So I think that with regards to the Iranian people, that is absolutely not correct. The Iranian people want what we want. They want the oil money brought to their dinner tables. They want freedom. They want the right to speak. They want their votes to be counted.
Well, we'll see how much of that gets on the table in Geneva. We're going to continue our discussion with Rudy Bakhtiar, so stay with us right now. Everything else you need to know this morning.
In the headlines at the White House today, the focus is on the war in Afghanistan. The president talks strategy with his national security team, and he'll sit down with a new NATO chief. That says 36 civilians are dead in southern Afghanistan after a roadside bomb hit a bus there. Back in the U.S., the number of people living in poverty is at an 11-year high. New census figures show household income dropped for all Americans. The income gap between the wealthy and the poor got even bigger.
A Colorado man suspected in an alleged bomb plot is in a New York City court today. Investigators say he trained at an Al-Qaeda camp in Pakistan. And the Secret Service says it's taking a Facebook survey on the president seriously. Someone posted a question asking if the president should be assassinated. Facebook says it took it down as soon as it knew about it. Wall Street rose nearly 2% yesterday. The Dow opens next hour at 97.89. The S&P starts trading at 10.63. And the Nasdaq begins at 21.31. Futures trading suggests a flat to negative opening when Wall Street gets underway. So the threats to the United States, what is the clear and present danger? We've got a project for you. As threats are assessed domestically and abroad, what do you think is the clear and present danger in the U.S.? 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake at thetakeaway.org.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Celeste Headlee.
Good morning, everyone. What did we say at the top of the hour? Countdown to Geneva. On Thursday, Iran and the G5 nations will sit down to take a look at Iran's nuclear program and see if common ground can be found as a way of moving forward. And the stage may, in fact, be set for what could be a fundamentally new relationship between Iran and the United States, or we may be returning to our corners and more posturing will supersede the discussions. Joining us now is David Sanger, Chief Washington Correspondent for The New York Times. He's the author of The Inheritance, The World Obama Confronts, and The Challenges to American Power. Good morning, David. We've talked about Iran quite a lot on this program.
We have, John.
Do you think it's possible that these talks on a longstanding issue of contention between Iran and the rest of the world, the nuclear program, could actually herald what Gary Sick said on this program yesterday, the long-delayed second act in U.S.-Iranian relations since the Islamic Revolution in 1979?
Well, boy, I sure hope Gary is right. But I think that to put too many expectations on this set of talks with a weakened Iranian government that probably is internally divided about what to say after the revelation of a covert nuclear program or plant that is actually on an Iranian Revolutionary Guard base. That might be a bit much. My expectations for this session are pretty low.
Now let's talk about the details there. The previously undisclosed uranium enrichment facility that you're referring to was discovered near the city of Qom, right?
That's right. It's in a mountainside in the city of Qom. And if you go on our look at our paper, go on our website today, we take you on a satellite photo and graphic tour of how they built this thing.
And it is underground, and it's suspicious in the sense that there seems to be a lot of effort to make it secret. Yet, given the pre-existing controversy between Iran and the rest of the world regarding nukes, does Iran have an argument that, of course, we have to keep it secret? I mean, there's precedent for people bombing preemptively nuclear facilities in our part of the world.
Absolutely. They've only got two big problems out of this. They have maintained consistently that their program is completely civilian. In other words, that they are making nuclear fuel for a nuclear power plant, something lots of countries do and something they're certainly permitted to do. It is hard to explain, however, why you would put a very small enrichment plant, which is really not economical for these purposes, under a mountain in the middle of an Iranian Revolutionary Guard Corps base. That does seem to have a certain military sort of tone to it. And so when they get to Geneva, if they get to Geneva, because they haven't even told the European Union yet for sure that they were going to show or where or when, and this is only, 48 hours away, if they go ahead with that, they would have to answer an awful lot of questions about this. Now, the U.S. position, John, is that Iran did not plan to make this public, at least not now, and only did when they found out that the United States and its allies had pierced the secrecy of this thing and were about to go reveal the intelligence.
Well, I guess, you know, the question is, what is the opportunity here, and will these talks change what we alluded to at the top of the hour, the sense that the Iranians and the Americans speak to each other like the Federation and the Klingons, not knowing each other's language and not being able to find common ground? As you point out, the government in Iran is in a weakened state since the elections, and we'll see if that makes it to the table. David Sanger, thanks so much. Chief Washington correspondent for the New York Times, author of The Inheritance, The World Obama Confronts, and The Challenges to American Power.
This is a momentous occasion.
Mr. President, we have
to go all media on this. I'll wear my blue Cerruti suit, and Jerry, I'll need a good speech. Statesmanlike, historical, and yet warm and neighborly. Abraham Lincoln meets Leave It to Beaver. You know the sort of thing.
Yes, sir.
What is the opportunity on Thursday when Iran and the United States and possibly four other nations sit down to talk about the nuclear program? We decided to ask some Iranian-Americans on the program who have different perspectives here. Iraj Mirshahi joins us. He's an Iranian-American doctor of internal medicine. He lives in Richmond, Virginia, moved to the U.S. from Iran in 1983. And you're of the generation that is certainly knowledgeable of the events of 1979, the original Iranian Revolution. Good morning, doctor.
Good morning.
Sunshine Rianian Lutter joins us here. She's a political organizer, lives in Brooklyn, was very briefly in Tehran. You're of a generation who maybe didn't witness the 1979 revolution, but certainly understand it by the events that have happened subsequently, correct?
Good morning, yes.
All right. And Rudy Bakhtiar, who we've already spoken to, you're the advocate on our panel. You are director of public relations for the Public Affairs Alliance of Iranian Americans. First of all, if you were in the talks, Rudy, I'll begin with you, in Geneva, what would you say to the Iranian delegation?
Well, I think first it's important to understand that I'm here on behalf of myself as an Iranian American. PAIA, the Public Affairs Alliance of Iranian Americans, has no foreign policy advocacy issues. Having said that, this is an issue that's come front and center on all of our radars. I actually grew up in Iran. I was there during the revolution. I witnessed the takeover by the mullahs of our country. And if I were there at the talks, I would want our president, Barack Obama, to make sure that he highlights the human rights violations that are going on inside the country. I think we're at a very critical moment here in Iranian history, and that is, this is the first chance in 30 years that the Iranian people have had to voice their opposition to this government. This is the first chance that this is the first time we've seen the supreme leader's position severely
right.
weakened.
You're referring to the elections and the events that have weakened the government that we referred to when we spoke with David Sanger. So you're advocating, Rudy Bakhtiar, a very hard line if Barack Obama has a chance to speak directly to the Iranians, and of course the nations will be speaking through delegations. Sunshine Riani and Lutter, what would you do if you were at these talks in Geneva on Thursday?
Well, that's an interesting question, because I don't really think of the U.S. government as the best messenger of kind of advocating for what should happen with Iran. And I really think Iranians themselves are the best messengers for themselves. As an Iranian-American, I support their efforts for self-determination and for, you know, doing what they need to do within the country.
What does that mean in terms of the nuclear program? Is that a part of self-determination to have this new facility that was disclosed last week?
It may be. I don't want to be on here as a nuclear expert. I mean, that's not something.
No, that's not why we asked you here. But
yeah.
No, you have an opinion, of course.
I mean, you know, I think that that's something that needs to be worked out through the protocols, through the international relations, through the legal mechanisms that are set up by the IAEA, you know, by the UN, et cetera. But I don't think it's, you know, the appropriate position for the U.S. government to say, you do what we say or else.
Okay, so you would not advocate a hard line, more of a, let's try to find some common ground here, and I'm not saying that one is better than the other. Iraj Mirshahi, what would you do if you were in those talks on Thursday?
Well, I think this is a great opportunity for us as Americans to start a new relation with the Iranian government and Iranian people. As Rudy said, right now there's a turmoil in Iran, there's a division amongst the leaders in Iran, and the Iranian people are looking for, you know, more freedom and human rights. And, you know, we all know that Iran has a right to have nuclear energy, but we absolutely don't want them to get into the nuclear power. That's going to be disastrous in Middle East. So I think there's opportunity for Obama to start a dialogue and hopefully continue it over the next few years.
But what do you make, Doctor, of some of the rhetoric from President Ahmadinejad, saying that Gordon Brown and Nicolas Sarkozy have no guts, and that they have no business saying anything to Iran on nuclear issues? And, of course, we haven't even talked about the whole question of the Holocaust.
Well, remember that, you know, Mr. Ahmadinejad has been saying a lot of these things over the last 4 or 5 years. He doesn't have a whole lot of power, you know, on his own. He's, you know, sort of following what the supreme leader is saying right now. But the position of supreme leader has been weakened also during the recent, you know, after the elections
right.
and all that. So I'm not sure if it's.
He's not the show. He's not what you should be watching, President Ahmadinejad, according to you. Okay, Sunshine, Riani, and Lutter.
I agree with Dr. Mirshahi. I think that it's very important. This is a critical time right now when you look at what's going on inside the country. And I don't advocate, as you said, a hardline position at all. I think that the United States play a very critical role here in somehow understanding what's going on inside the country and using this opportunity to strengthen a movement inside the country for a reformed government, because it will make a big difference for us here in the United
States.
Well,
the question is,
can
that message get beyond the table and get beyond the people of the government that the G5 nations will be talking to? Sunshine, Riani, and Lutter, I'll let you have the last word. Just a couple of seconds here.
I'd just like to say that in terms of our government here in the U.S., that we really we should make sure not to go for economic sanctions. It's really crippling to the people in the country versus the government.
Where will those talks go on Thursday? Thanks to Iraj Mashashi, Iranian-American doctor from Virginia, Sunshine Riani and Lutter, and who's a political organizer in Brooklyn, and Rudy Bakhtiar, an Iranian-American living in Washington. Thanks to all three of you. We'll all be watching those talks on Thursday.
You're listening to The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International, in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
And so now let's get some quick takeouts on stories that you have to be up to date on because they change from day to day. We're going to start with Todd Zwillick, Takeaway's Washington correspondent. Todd, on health care reform, they've been running some numbers in the House and the Senate, and it seems lawmakers are trying to save billions by taking a real hard look at benefits for seniors. Seems like dangerous political territory, Todd.
It's some of the most dangerous political territory there is, the so-called third rail of politics. So you're right, John. They want to cut billions of dollars from Medicare. But here's the question. Does it cut benefits? And I thought it would be a good time to do some truth squatting because this debate has really been heating up between the parties on the Hill. It's going to get even hotter. I want you to listen first to the Republican point of view. As the Democrats' bill tries to cut about $380 billion in spending from Medicare over the next decade. Listen to this.
I think, Mr. Chairman, that it's disingenuous to say that Congress can cut this much spending for Medicare without having an adverse effect on seniors' access to health care. It's just absolutely counterintuitive.
All right, that's Republican right. John Kyle
of Arizona.
Seems
clear enough.
Okay, so listen to the Democratic point of view here.
Yes, there are some provider cuts, and yes, there are some cuts that those providers are going to tell their seniors that their services are going to be cut, but they're not going to be cut. They're not going to be cut.
What is he saying?
Okay, so who's right here? It's true. The Democrats want to cut hundreds of billions of dollars from Medicare spending. They want to cut payments to, hospitals and nursing homes, certainly to insurance companies that deliver Medicare HMOs. They hate that program. So you heard Jay Rockefeller there. There are cuts, and he's right, but the bill makes no legal cuts to Medicare benefits.
Wait a second. Can I just ask you a question about what Rockefeller said? So Rockefeller says there will be cuts to providers, but it's up to the providers to cut the benefits to the seniors.
No, he's saying it's up to the providers to take the hit. We're cutting providers, but we're not going to cut benefits. So the Democrats are right on this. They're nowhere in the bill, and all the benefits in Medicare are legally defined. Not just amorphous. Nowhere in the bill does it say we're cutting benefits. So the Democrats are right. But Republicans may be right, too. How long do you think a program with $400 billion less to spend can offer the same benefits, right?
All right. Well, I mean, $400 billion, that's a real chunk of change, even in this economic environment. Todd Zwillick, Takeaway Washington correspondent. Thanks for that.
My pleasure.
Now, a takeout on finances for this hour. We're joined by Louise Story, finance reporter for our partner, The New York Times. Hi, Louise.
Hi, guys.
So in a few hours, the FDIC is going to be meeting. And one thing people are forgetting is that we haven't really talked a lot about the fact that there are still banks failing. This 93 have failed so far this year. The FDIC is worried, and lawmakers are worried, that the FDIC will not have enough money to insure those banks, to pay up as the government insurer of the savings accounts for people who are at the banks that are failing. So what is the FDIC going to do about this?
So the FDIC's board has to figure out how they're going to meet their cost. And what we've seen is that as these banks fail, they have to use money not only to cover deposits, but also just for the cost of unwinding them and selling the assets. It's actually pretty expensive to do that. The fund is down at $10 billion. It was up at $30 billion earlier in the year. So this is the worst since the savings and loans crisis. So it is a big problem. And they're pondering their options. There's probably three or four main options they may do. One thing that they could do is tap a line of credit from the Treasury. The thing about that is that it's taxpayer money and, people are a little wary of more bailouts, and this would be a bailout for the banks through the FDIC. They could also levy another fine on the banks, which the banks may pass on to consumers as they've done in the past. Or they may borrow from the banks themselves, which would kind of turn the tables on this whole bailout thing, if you think about it, right? Because
it would
it's
be
not
the
that
government
long ago
bailing out the banks.
Government was helping the banks, right?
Right. So, we've spent $20 billion so far this year for 93 banks to fail. But have we hit bottom? Is this kind of the tailing off of banks failing?
Well, there's another 416 banks that are high risk. So, a lot of banking experts think this is going to go on for quite some time.
Holy
It'll take a very
cow.
Long time for the pain to work through the system.
Talk
Remember,
about
a
cash
lot of these
clunkers.
Little banks gave, bad real estate loans.
But if the FDIC doesn't have the money to insure these banks, does it still have the money to insure my savings account?
So you don't need to run hide your money under your mattress quite yet, probably, because if the FDIC does run out of money, the federal government, backs it. So, you know, as long as we've got a safe government, they'll secure your deposit up to $250,000.
That's a little scary, Louise. Louise Story, finance reporter for our partner, The New York Times. Thanks.
The ultimate insurance. You and me, the taxpayers.
That's right. There we go.
Well, a takeout finally now from Ibrahim Abdul-Mateen, Takeaway sports contributor. So the NFL, what do they make? They make stars, right? But to be a star in the NFL, you have to deliver. And that was really the narrative for Tony Romo last night at the Monday night football game, the Dallas Cowboys versus Carolina. What happened?
Well, okay, first of all, just thinking about Carolina Panthers, they're a team looking for their soul. After going 12-4 last year, they won their division, the NFC South. The Cowboys also projected to be contenders almost every single year. Tony Romo, he's supposed to win a Super Bowl ring. And thinking of scheduling these two teams for a primetime game last year would have been golden. You get Carolina versus Cowboys, that means that's money right there. And just to clarify, the QB is Jake Delhomme for the Carolina Panthers,
right,
and their running back, D'Angelo Williams. Those are two of the best people in the league at their position last year. And coming into this season, that's the way it was. So basically coming into this game, it was a great matchup, except both teams weren't playing great football.
I mean, they faltered in the early going.
Totally.
And Romo has faltered, and the Carolina personnel have really not delivered. First of all, what was the score last night?
21-7, and that was and
Cowboys won.
Cowboys won, yeah. and it was close up until the end of the last 5 minutes of the fourth quarter when a guy named Terrence Newman got an interception and basically saved the day for the Cowboys, for the stands, for the owner, and for Tony Romo. And it was completely nothing that the offense did because they were playing very conservative, trying not to turn the ball over.
A Cowboy quarterback always has to be perfect, right?
Well, that's the thing. Troy Aikman actually last year was saying that he doesn't think that Tony Romo understands what it means to be the quarterback of the Cowboys. And I think that that's a major statement. And Tony Romo was undrafted. He was a free agent. He came into the league. He proved himself. And that's the story really behind this. If you're sitting at home wondering, what am I going to say around the water cooler today? Talk about Tony Romo actually coming up and not making a mistake today.
Without Jessica Simpson, right? Is that the other narrative there?
Exactly.
Okay, so let's talk about some injuries. We got some very serious injuries over the weekend that really take some people out for the year. Chad Pennington.
And then, exactly. There were another team, the Miami, that won their division last year. Chad Pennington had redeemed himself after getting booted out of New York City playing with the Jets, and now Chad Pennington is no longer, he's not going to play for the rest of the season. His shoulder is done.
It's sad. They got to shrink the size of these NFL players to keep some of these people in. Finally, we've seen two shots now, the Jerry Jones football plex in Dallas on TV. What do you make of it?
The Mountain of Mordor.
Mountain of Mordor. Thank you, Ibrahim Abdul-Mateen, the Takeaway sports contributor.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Celeste Headlee.
Coming up, floods have killed hundreds of people in the Philippines. We're going to get an update on relief efforts there in just a moment. Here are some of the news stories we're following, though, at 32 minutes after the hour. President Obama talks Afghanistan today with NATO's new chief, and senators are debating plans to add a so-called public option to Max Baucus's health care bill today.
Movie director Roman Polanski is fighting extradition to America with a new motion in Swiss courts. He fled the U.S. more than three decades ago after pleading guilty to having sex with a minor. More news from the Philippines. Two U.S. troops are dead after a roadside bomb there. Al-Qaeda-linked militants are blamed for that.
And in more news out of the Philippines.
We saw water coming into our house. Then around after 5 minutes, the water level was already chest deep. If we hadn't exerted effort to climb up to the second floor, we would have died.
Relief efforts are continuing in the capital of the Philippines, Manila, after heavy rainfall from a typhoon caused the worst flooding in 40 years there. That city has 12 million people of it. Parts of that city are underwater, up to 20 feet of it, and more than 200 people are now known to have died. At least 37 are missing. The government admits they're struggling to cope, and two new storms are forming in the Pacific. They could come into the Philippines as typhoons as early as Friday. From Manila, we speak to Stephen Anderson. He's the head of the World Food Program in the Philippines. So, Stephen, explain to me, how severe is it there right now? How many people are in danger? How many people have been rescued?
Well, the as you stated, the relief effort is gathering pace. It started immediately, even on Saturday when the rains were falling. But of course, the magnitude of the damage became clear as time went on. the estimate is that about 1.9 million people have been affected by this flooding, and it's really devastated some parts. It's not all parts of Manila have still have water, only certain parts. But it is a very dramatic. I mean, water in some cases up to 20 feet high was, and it moved vehicles around just like toys. I mean, there were a lot of stories of people, very dramatic rescues.
Obviously, it's not just Manila that's affected by this. What are the most urgent needs? I mean, other than getting people off of their roofs and getting them to safety, what is the most important thing right now to help these people?
Well, the most important need that the government is confirming is our water, to get clean water to the affected people, and to get to address health issues, also to make sure that that they have adequate food and support in terms of getting them back, especially the 600,000 or so who are displaced out of their homes, half of whom are in evacuation centers. So I think the priority is to get that group back on their feet as fast as possible. So the government really is flat out working flat out, and they appealed yesterday. Monday, they've actually requested the United Nations to coordinate international appeal in terms of channeling international assistance to best help the government. So that I think everybody wants to help at this time. There's a huge outpouring of sympathy and generosity. But it's just to make sure that this can be channeled in the most effective way and help the government to have the maximum impact in getting people back on their feet. We do see some examples where it is working very well, but there are still some areas where access is extremely difficult. The water is even in some cases neck deep.
So part of that international relief that's coming to you is Bing Branigan. She's a community liaison for National Federation of Filipino American Associations. Bing is going to Manila tomorrow to coordinate efforts with the Red Cross. And Bing, you're sending plane loads of medicine to the Philippines today. Is that correct?
Yes, that's through Americare.
So how do you see, I mean, how is your organization preparing for this? I mean, what kind of numbers are you expecting to be able to serve?
The 3 million Filipinos in America are now doing their own fundraising, and we're going to use the Philippine National Red Cross to course through this money. We are also being assisted by the consulates all over the U.S. and the embassy, so that it can be a coordinated effort, and we don't want to be sending materials or hardware or logistics that are not needed at this time. So the focus is raising money at this moment here in the U.S.
Do you think the government was prepared for this kind of disaster? Did they have enough supplies and equipment?
I don't think so. The magnitude that hit the Philippines this past weekend was so much, too much for them to cope with. As I said, there's not enough logistics. Number two, they have Doppler, but it's not equipped, or the equipment has not arrived to measure how much water or how strong the wind, and people were not evacuated on time.
So there's another storm coming in that could be a typhoon hitting the Philippines as early as Friday. With your relief effort, are you trying to also bring in enough supplies to maybe serve the people who are going to get displaced come this weekend?
Yeah, absolutely. We will prepare for those things right now. But as I said, it's better to get all the monies right now, and then we will ask Red Cross in the Philippines to send those money.
So Bing is heading to Manila tomorrow. Stephen, you are in Manila now. How about the storm that is coming on Friday? Is the area going to be prepared? Are people going to be rescued out of their homes and safe before more storms hit this weekend?
Well, we don't know yet exactly the trajectory of the storm. As it looks now, it looks like it may rain on the area, but it will not have a direct strike on Manila. That's the information that we have now. But, of course, we are, and so we're Our plans are geared, of course, to trying to assist the people who are affected now, the 1.9 million, and particularly those who are in the evacuation centers. If indeed more rains come, this will certainly compound the situation and complicate the situation. But at the same time, I think that there is coordination among certainly the government and the groups that are trying to assist. And I think that we're building in as best we can contingencies and trying to ensure that we try to address the most affected people first and foremost. And of course, we're just hoping and praying that these other storms do not hit us, because that will actually exacerbate the situation significantly.
It would certainly take a lot longer for the waters to recede there. That's Stephen Anderson, head of the World Food Program in the Philippines, and Bing Branigan. Safe trip to Manila tomorrow. She's the community liaison for National Federation of Filipino American Associations. This is The Takeaway. I'm Celeste Headlee.
And I'm John Hockenberry. Celeste, remember when the news cycle was like 24 hours? I mean, when it was like once every 24 hours was
rather than once
every 24 seconds.
Right.
It used to be weekly, actually, hundreds of years. In the Gutenberg era, it was, probably months.
I don't remember
a time.
It clearly, but yes.
Yeah. Well, I was a young child in the Gutenberg era. Joining us now is Motoko Rich, New York Times reporter who covers the publishing industry, which really is in the age of Gutenberg in terms of how quickly it takes a book to be published. I've turned in manuscripts and had to wait a year before the book came out. You write this morning, Motoko Rich, that there's an initiative to really change that and reduce the cycle more along the lines of what we see in cable and internet news iterations.
Well, it's probably somewhere in between. And Tina Brown, the maestro of many magazines, the Vanity Fair, the New Yorker, and then the somewhat ill-fated Talk magazine, who's now running the Daily Beast, has had her metabolism ramped up in going online. And so she wants to move the book publishing industry into the 21st century. It's probably not going to be quite as fast as cable news or the internet, but it's certainly going to be much, much faster than the book publishing industry, as you mentioned.
Well, what does this mean? We've heard of instant books, where a book will come out right after a news event.
Absolutely.
I remember the first one that I recall was when the Berlin Wall fell. There were books out within a few months, but we've managed to shorten that even today. How much shorter are we talking about?
Well, sometimes those instant books now come out in a matter of weeks. What Tina Brown is proposing is that she's going to select from her cadre of writers on the Daily Beast to write on subjects that they've already explored on the internet so that they know that there's interest from readers. And then they'll have something like a month to 3 months to write the book, and then they want to turn the book around within a month. And what is enabling part of this is this e-book technology that's growing more and more popular.
The Kindle and other platforms.
Absolutely. Even on your computer, you could read these books, and so that they don't have this long production cycle. The other thing that Tina has to offer is this sort of major marketing platform. One of the reasons that publishers say that it takes them so long to produce books is that they have to kind of seed the marketplace. They have to tell booksellers about this book. They have to line up magazine profiles and TV appearances. She does this all the time with her Daily Beast writers, and so she figures she can use both the web platform and her contacts in the media to get that marketing machine rolling much more quickly.
All right, but what about the idea that this is just Tina Brown wants to fire all the copy editors and force me, the reader, to do the spell check on my own when I get this manuscript delivered to my Kindle?
Well, let's hope that's not quite what they're expecting, but I think there is a sense in which these books will not be quite of the sort of depth and analysis or length of, say, a book that you might have written and taken a long time to produce. What she's imagining is this is going to fill the gap that's increasingly being left by closing magazines and such. So she had told me in an interview yesterday that pieces that might previously have run at great length in a GQ, an Esquire, New Yorker, Vanity Fair, what have you, this is kind of a slot. So we're not talking about books that would naturally take 1 or 2 years to produce, the definitive history of John Adams. We're talking about, shorter books on political issues at the moment.
So here's the takeaway, Motoko Rich. The 20,000-word New Yorker piece on bats lives in this genre.
In ebook form.
In ebook form. So magazine pieces that were long, that would cease to exist as the magazine ceased to exist, might be in these new... Who's going to publish these books?
Beast Books and Perseus Books, which is a large independent publisher.
All right, Tina Brown's latest initiative to shorten the iterations in the publishing industry. It's the subject of Motoko Rich's piece in our partner, The New York Times, this morning. Thank you, Motoko.
Listening to The Takeaway from Public Radio International and WNYC in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning, everyone. John Hockenberry here with Celeste Headlee. The challenge of leaving it at the office. It's a productivity question. We talk about work every Tuesday, and we'll talk about how you increase productivity by actually making time to turn it all off. We're also talking about what should be America's priority right now. Is it Iran, Al-Qaeda, the economy, healthcare? What is the clear and present danger to the United States right now?
This is Bruce from down east Maine, the other state of Maine, and it's absolutely the economy, because with all the changes that have been made in Washington, it seems that still there's nothing getting done.
Tell us at 877-8-MY-TAKE or send an email to mytake@thetakeaway.org. And here are some of the news stories we're following at 48 minutes after the hour. At the White House today, the focus is the war in Afghanistan. The president talks strategy with the new NATO chief. And in the Philippines, hundreds are dead and the death toll is rising. Flooding from a typhoon has killed hundreds. A few minutes ago on The Takeaway, the head of the World Food Program told us some 1.9 million people are affected. 600,000 are in temporary shelters.
The number of Americans living in poverty is at an 11-year high. New census figures show household income dropped across the board, and the income gap between the wealthy and the poor grew. The Colorado man charged in an alleged bomb plot is in a New York court this morning. Prosecutors say he got bomb training at an Al-Qaeda camp in Pakistan. Next hour, we'll get a look at the housing market. The latest Case-Shiller home price index is coming out. We'll break those numbers down for you when they come out. Those are some of the stories we're watching this morning. It's Tuesday. That means we're talking about work issues. And there's a very interesting study out in the new issue of the Harvard Business Review. It's authored by Leslie Perlow. She's a professor of leadership in the organizational behavior area at the Harvard Business School. What it basically says is that if employers force their workers to take at least one night off, completely off,
force them. So they say, you go home
you
tonight.
Go home, you turn off your BlackBerry. You turn off your iPhone.
Does my boss come home with
no
me?
No text. Hopefully not. That would be taking work home with you, you see?
That's right.
No texts, no Twitters. Nothing.
Wow.
The workers end up happier, and they're more efficient at work. Leslie, good morning.
Good morning.
So how did you measure this? How do you measure whether a worker is happier and more efficient on the job?
So we actually tracked in detail how many hours they were working every week, and we found that the team that we tracked the closest reduced their hours 5 hours a week. But I think it's really important to emphasize that while this was about an efficiency gain, what really was going on here was that it was a predictable gain. So they knew ahead of time, just like in the medical world, when your doctors are either on or on call, but they're also off. And here for us, it was really important to try to take that concept of being off, predictably off, and make it comparable in the business world. And so what we were trying to do was to put that into the workplace so that it was not just efficient, but they were predictably off. And in addition, by working as a team to try to create that predictable time off, it forced them to actually think about how they were doing their work as a team and to challenge some very deeply held assumptions about how work had to be done and to realize things could be done differently. So in the end,
so basically, if they know they can't call their colleagues that night, if they know they can't finish up this project sometime during the evening, that means they're going to get it done during the daytime because they can't do it that night, right?
Absolutely. But it's not just at the individual level, right? So now, as a group, they're having to rethink how they're working.
Okay. Also with us is Beth Koblener, author of Get a Financial Life, Personal Finance in Your 20s and 30s. So, Beth, can we say, is this extrapolated out? I mean, she's talking about people who took 5 hours a week devoted away from work, so that if you take 10 hours, you'll be even more efficient?
Right. It's really interesting. And I have to say, it's not the first time this was done. For example, during the Great Depression, Kellogg's, you know, the cornflake people,
sure.
What they did was they reduced shifts from 8 hours to 6 hours. And what they found was quite fascinating, that people were actually happier at work They were happy to have the shorter shift, and they were happy outside of the home. You know, they were showing reports back then in the 30s, early 30s, that they had more time with their family and friends. You know, the reports were showing, they said women had more time to sow and garden and men had time, more time to hunt and farm. And so it was, you know, a real big radical shift that was going on. Leisure time was up and productivity at work was up. So, you know, whether we're at the point now we're starting to evaluate output rather than actual hours worked, because, you know, for years in America, I think we've said the more hours you put in,
right,
you know, you show your boss you're there late, you're the first one in, the last one to leave. That's sort of the way to evaluate somebody's, how hard you're working is how well you're doing.
Well, we have someone here who's actually trying this in the workplace. Grant Freeland is a senior partner and managing director at the Boston Consulting Group. Grant, your employees are actually trying this whole thing out of guaranteed complete non-work hours, correct?
That's correct.
And how has that worked out for you day to day?
So look, we've found that it actually creates value. But I would like to stress with what Leslie said, which is if we simply said to our staff, work less, you know, reduce the number of hours per day, I don't think we would have seen any benefit whatsoever. However, by looking at creating a short amount of time that was predictable, that had secondary effects. It meant that we had to think about how we did our work. And by thinking about how we did our work, we got smarter. But we also had the secondary benefit of working people less. But the working less, I think, is a result, not an input to this thing. It really is about getting some predictability, getting open communication, and then for working smarter.
Did you have resistance? Were there people who just didn't want to turn the BlackBerry off or who were sending secret text messages cheating?
I think that all people who join consulting have a little bit of desire to keep working and working. So there were instances where people wouldn't turn their BlackBerries off and cheated on the margin. But once it becomes part of a culture, and once you actually see that good work can be smart work, we started to work around those issues.
But Grant, did you actually say to one of your employees, hey, you can't be doing that. You got to be doing your son's homework tonight?
Well, I'm not sure if I ever said son's homework, but we certainly said that you shouldn't be working on that time off period.
So, Leslie, is this, I mean, he's at a consulting firm. That seems like a relatively easy place to implement this. How could this possibly work, say, in a factory setting or a restaurant or somewhere else?
So I think that if you think at the essence of what we're doing, which is trying to create a constraint and have people think about how they're going to do it differently, it should work in any team. So as soon as we're having an opportunity to rethink collectively, the idea of predictable time off can be at an individual level. You can put it in yourself and do the best you can to be more efficient. But that to us is just better individual time management.
Leslie Perlow is a professor of leadership at the Harvard Business School. We also heard from Grant Freeland, senior partner and managing director at the Boston Consulting Group. And, of course, Beth Kobliner, author of Get a Financial Life, Personal Finance in Your 20s and 30s.
She does my time management. Beth does. She's great.
She needs to get to work.
You know, in these segments every week, we often start conversations that continue on our website. And we certainly started one last week. And you can go to our website, thetakeaway.org, and replay a conversation that we did about the younger people in America. I mean, the fact that people are coming out as gay younger and younger. At a younger and younger age, it's a piece in the New York Times Magazine. But we started a conversation that's still going on. Here's Susan in Oklahoma.
I have a child who is now 14. And when she was younger, I made it very clear to her that it doesn't matter to me if she is gay or straight or bi or asexual. I would love her no matter what, and I would support her choices. And I hope that other moms can maybe have the talk with their kids.
You know, it's a story about being gay and straight in the United States. It's also a story about the changing relationship between parents and kids. Mark in New York emails us at mytake@thetakeaway.org. I came out as soon as I realized I was gay. Now, as a 30-year-old adult, I find that closeted individuals are not only lying to themselves, but they are doing a great disservice to the advancement of society as a whole. For others, it's not so easy. This anonymous post on thetakeaway.org, I really wish I could have come out at an early age. As a black male, homosexuality is a cultural no-no and can bring great shame and emotional pain. I chose to hide my sexuality and conform. I entered into many relationships with women and fathered a child. Over the past 4 years, I've learned to accept my homosexuality and am in a monogamous relationship with a man I truly love. I'm 31 years old and I'm financially independent, but so frightened of coming out to my family still. Here's one final anonymous email we got. I've been married to a gay man for 19 years, and 5 years ago he came out. Our divorce will be final next month. He says he knew he was gay before he even knew there was a word for it. However, he was taught that it was a sin and that God hates gays, so he prayed for a miracle. You can give us your take out on any conversation that we have on the program. Call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE. Leave a comment at thetakeaway.org, and you can find us at Facebook and Twitter.
We're also asking you, what should be America's priority right now? What is the clear and present danger on the horizon? Is it Iran? Is it Afghanistan? Al-Qaeda? The economy? Healthcare? Let us know.
This is David from Putnam, Connecticut. I really think that our clear and present danger is our dependence on foreign oil. Everything else seems to key off that.
Tell us what you think at 877-8-MY-TAKE or send us an email to mytake@thetakeaway.org. Of course, you can reach us there with anything that has you talking about the news, just like Iran.
My name's Christy Anderson. I'm in Michigan. And I believe that President Obama calling out Iran at the summit the other day basically is going to silence all the chicken hawks and right-wing people who are calling for war with Iran.
We'll see if that's true. 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake@thetakeaway.org.
You know how to reach us. I'm John Hockenberry.
I'm Celeste Headley, and this is The Takeaway. Option in healthcare was never really dead.
You think I'm licked? You all think I'm licked? Well, I'm not licked. And I'm going to stay right here and fight for this lost cause.
But as always, the devil is in the details.
We need to come to order. We're going to begin with Sarah Lincoln, who will give her opening statement. Then we'll return amendment offered by Sarah Nelson from Florida. After that, we'll return to amendments on the list.
Nitty gritty.
Getting down to the nitty-gritty with the public option on The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Celeste Headley from WNYC and PRI.
Good morning. It's Tuesday, September 29th. I'm Celeste Headley here with John Hockenberry.
Good morning, Celeste. This hour, a difference of opinion among intelligence agencies could affect U.S. policy with Iran. We're going to go inside the hunt for truth about Iran's nuclear program. And look at this. Our old friend,
Freakonomics
author Stephen Dubner joins us to talk about his latest discovery and his latest book, How Freakonomics in Maternity Wards Saved Millions of Lives.
But first, Takeaway correspondent Todd Zwillick joins us. Todd, we keep hearing that there's 80% of people polled support the public option in healthcare. So if that's true, why can't Congress swallow it?
Yeah, well, it depends on who you ask and how you ask it. If there's 80%, maybe 70%, even if it were 65, look, the public option, you've heard the rhetoric, Celeste. The public option is vulnerable to accusations of big government takeover of healthcare. If you ask people the question that way, do you want government to take over healthcare? They say no. Also, you need 60 votes in the Senate. It's designed to not pass things. And you have all these moderate to conservative Democrats in the House and Senate who won big in the last election. They don't want to be vulnerable to accusations of socialism. It's a tough lift for the politics on this.
Okay, and yet the public option is alive and well, at least in debate this week. Stay with us, Todd. We'll be back with you in a moment. But first, everything else you need to know this morning.
Well, the closely watched Standard & Poor's Case-Shiller Home Price Index of 20 major cities rose 1.2% from June. It's continued improvement, 6 months of improvement in that home price index. We've been seeing the housing industry bouncing up and down in the economy over the last few months. In the headlines, the focus on Afghanistan is in the Oval Office today. The president kicks off a series of security meetings by sitting down with the new head of NATO, and poverty is on the rise as the gap between rich and poor continues to grow. New census figures show poverty at an 11-year high.
The Colorado man suspected in an alleged bomb plot is in a New York court today. Investigators say he trained at an Al-Qaeda camp in Pakistan and planned an attack with homemade bombs. And the Secret Service is investigating a Facebook survey that asked if the president should be killed. Facebook took the poll down. Wall Street rose nearly 2% yesterday. The Dow opens this hour at 97.89. The S&P will start trading at 10.63, and the Nasdaq will open up at 21.31. So, is it the economy, those Wall Street numbers? Is that the biggest priority in America today? What do you think is the clear and present danger in the United States today? If there is one, let us know. Is it Iran, Al-Qaeda, the economy, healthcare? John, what is the clear and present danger?
The clear and present danger. I have made no lunch plans today. That's my clear and present danger.
Well, that's
what I'm facing. 877-8-MY-TAKE or send an email to mytake@thetakeaway.org. I'm sure you can come up with something better than that.
We'll be right back.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Celeste Headlee.
I was hoping for the public option.
Is there still a possibility that the public option will be included?
And without public option, there will be no health care.
If they don't have a public option for people to choose or elect to go into, then it's just putting an insurance company's profits above basic health care of our population.
So that's the sound of you, our listeners. A majority of those who call into the program, admittedly a small sampling, have said that you're in favor of a public option. But this actually matches a lot of surveys out there. Joining us is Todd Zwillick, Takeaway's Washington correspondent. So, Todd, we have all these different polls. In June, the New York Times and CBS poll said 72% supported the government-sponsored health care plan. In June, also a different one run by the Wall Street Journal, 76% said that a public option is very important. So if we have the support among the public for at least some kind of public option, maybe not all public option, why is it so difficult for the legislators to swallow this?
Well, of course, it depends on how you ask. You know, if you say, do you support a public option in healthcare, you're right. 75-72% of people in various polls would say yes. But what if you ask them, are you for a government takeover of part of healthcare? Well, most of them will say no.
Are those equivalent propositions?
Yeah,
though?
I was just about to ask the same thing. They're not the same thing.
Well, that's the thing. They're not. However, members of Congress respond to both of those things. And the latter statement, are you for a government takeover of healthcare? You've heard it in the debate over and over. That's why people who are opposed to the public option repeat it ad nauseum over and over. They know that people don't want that. That's the rhetoric. And you're asking, you know, about the politics of this. If the polls show that people do want the so-called government option, well, members of Congress, you know, it really depends to them what rhetoric people are responding to. You know, you have to also remember, even though Democrats have a huge majority in Congress, not all of them are liberals. And in this last election, a big, big chunk of moderate to conservative Democrats won in Republican districts. And those districts are much more aligned with the Republican agenda. And most of them are probably very nervous about voting for the so-called Obamacare, voting for the Pelosi care in the next election. So for them, you know, the national polls don't mean much in their district.
But, you know, Todd, all jokes aside, the legislators aren't really that stupid. I mean, it's very clear to say that the difference of having a public option and government taking over healthcare are different things. Isn't it possibly the case that instead of really believing that that's true, that those are the same thing, that maybe they're against a public option and they're twisting the polls to support that view?
Oh, I'm Celeste, you're exactly right. I wouldn't put it past any of our illustrious politicians to twist public opinion or the perception of it to what they already want to do. Let's face it, there are some very, very, very powerful forces in Washington who do not want this. The insurance industry does not want it. The drug companies don't want it. The device manufacturers certainly don't want it. And even though healthcare reform is moving forward and probably will pass in some form, don't count any of those constituencies out. They're strong as can be. They don't want it, and members are surely responding to that. And some members are opposed to it philosophically. You know, it's frustrating, I think, for a lot of Democrats who know they have the majority in the Senate and the House and who really want this strong public option to think that they may not get it out of the Senate. You know, the Senate is designed to not pass legislation. That's why you need 60. The founding...
That's not exactly right. It's designed not to have the majority rule over the minority.
It's designed to make it really tough. And to not necessarily respond to the so-called passions of the public,
right,
you know.
Right.
So that's the dynamic we're seeing.
How seriously, because at some point they're going to have to try and match up the Senate bill with the House bill. So how seriously should we take these comments from the members of the House saying they will not vote for a bill without a public option, no matter what the Senate passes?
Right. Well, it's a really interesting question, and you have to take them very seriously, because this very week, what the House leadership is doing is stitching together its three separate bills into one package that's going to go on the House floor in the next couple of weeks. And they are going for a really, what's likely to be a very strong, very liberal, if you will, sort of core Democratic public option. And these are all negotiating tactics. Eventually, the House passed bill will have to get into a negotiation, a conference with the Senate, which will probably not have a public option, at least not in a form that most Democrats and certainly the core Democrats would like to see. So everybody's staking out the strongest position they can. And ultimately, I think the most interesting thing about this is that it really comes down to whose side Barack Obama is on. Nancy Pelosi has said a bill will not pass the House without a strong public option. Max Baucus on his side says a public option can't get 60 in the House. Ultimately, it's going to come down to which side the president takes and which bill he'll sign. That's really what it's about.
Okay, Todd Zwillick is Takeaway's Washington correspondent. And Barack Obama may come down to the side of economy. This Congressional Budget Office says a public option could save them $110 billion.
Well, what do you think about all this? We've been asking you to kind of assemble a list of priorities in America. Healthcare is certainly one of them. But what's the clear and present danger for America right now? We've been asking you that at 877-8-MY-TAKE. And listen to what one listener just told us.
Ed Helmrich, Larchmont, New York. I think the biggest danger right now is that the president's health care bill, if it passes, will expand abortion in the United States to the largest degree since the passage of Roe v. Wade and euthanasia. I know it would be a disaster.
Healthcare, expanding abortion? Well, that's one of the issues that David Kirkpatrick is here to talk about. He's a Washington correspondent for our partner, the New York Times. Why would that listener be talking about that? Well, we've seen it before. Let me set it up here. The big debates and landmark pieces of legislation tend to bring out the big guns on Capitol Hill, not the senior senators, not the celebrity photo ops, no procedural ploys and legislative gambits to derail legislation. And, you know, you might see an amendment supporting troops in Iraq and Afghanistan to force a vote on some unrelated issue. But abortion is entering the health care debate. It may be a symbolic vote and an ideological showdown issue in the past, but here it's not unrelated to health care, and it could be very, very crucial. David Kirkpatrick, how is abortion on a collision course with the health care debate? And you heard that listener there.
For about 30 years now, the status quo in Washington has been no federal funds, no taxpayer monies should go to pay for abortion. And right now, in the context of the health care debate, everybody agrees with that, at least on paper. The president has said many times he's going to be sure that's the case. The Democratic leaders in Congress also agree. But the problem is that the nature of health care reform is to extend the federal government's role in providing health insurance. So you're going to have the federal government paying, subsidizing health care for millions of people. And that raises the novel question. Will the government allow those people? Will it support those people when they buy health insurance that covers abortion? Or won't they? And how are you going to make that distinction? So now come some Democrats who say, all right, we worked out a system. We'll require the insurance companies that receive these public subsidies to cover millions of Americans to keep their money in two different vaults, so to speak. Their public money over here and their private money from copayments or premiums over here. And that private money they can use to pay for abortion.
So that would be a matter of accounting, enforcing it by forcing insurance companies to say, all right, if there are abortions covered under this plan, they come from money that has nothing to do with a public subsidy that someone might have to actually buy that insurance, right?
Yeah, that's right. And they say, well, look, we've got, you know, 17 states have Medicaid programs that cover abortion. Medicaid, as you know, is partly funded by the government and partly by the states. And these 17 states do the same thing. They segregate out their federal funds. They use their state funds to cover abortion. But now comes people on the other side, including many conservative Democrats, who say, wait a second, you know, you're talking about a line in an accounting book and a ledger dividing public money from abortion. That seems bogus to me. There's nothing in here that's going to discourage abortion. In fact, you're going to be helping a lot of people buy health care coverage that will encourage abortion.
David, let's talk about what that listener was just saying there. I mean, his impression was that the net effect of the plan as being considered right now in Congress would expand federally supported abortions to an extraordinary degree, and he calls it a disaster. Is he right about that? Can you make that argument?
No, he's wrong about that. You know, this bill is not going to increase or decrease the number of abortions. That's a mischaracterization. I mean, there are real moral stakes if you consider the use of taxpayer funds to pay for abortions to be a moral issue. But in point of fact, studies have shown, for example, that not that many women who seek abortions even bother to file a claim with their insurer if their insurer covers it. I think something like 18% of abortions are paid for by insurance. Partly, you know, you can ask yourself why that is, but I think a lot of women who are going through the procedure just decide they don't want to involve a third party. So it's not like There's no scenario here where the extension of this insurance coverage causes a lot of women to rush to doctors to have abortions performed, or on the contrary, penalizes them in such a way that they won't
right.
be able to obtain abortions.
Well, in the last couple of seconds, the scenario that is likely, though, is that the voltage in the health care reform debate is going to be raised because of this issue, abortion. True or false?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, it's one of the most emotional issues in the country for the last 30 years. And whenever you add abortion to any debate, you might as well just turn up the heat.
All right. Well, that's definitely going to be happening here. David Kirkpatrick, Washington correspondent for our partner, The New York Times, talking about the abortion issue in the health care reform debate. Thank you, David.
It's a pleasure.
You can email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org or call us toll-free at 877-8-MYTAKE.
869-8253.
You're listening to The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International, in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
And now some quick takeouts on stories that we're following this week. We're going to start with Louise Story, finance reporter for our partner, The New York Times. Good morning, Louise. So great news on the housing front, right? The Treasury Department is going to give $35 billion in mortgage relief. This is going to go straight to the homeowners who have lost their jobs and are struggling to pay their mortgage payments, right?
Good morning. Well, of course, we don't really know if it's good news or not, because we don't know if this government bet on housing is going to pay off or not. We don't know the details of this program yet. We expect it this week sometime. It should be tens of billions of dollars that the government is going to push out to the mortgage market, possibly through the states. But I think if you step back a little, what's interesting is that the government is really effectively running the housing market now. And I've really enjoyed the segment you all have been doing where you ask regular people what they're seeing on the ground with their houses.
Mm-hmm.
But what they haven't been saying is that those sold signs are really the hand of the government. And there wouldn't be many sold signs without the government supporting the market.
So if the Treasury Department did not do this new $35 billion relief plan, that you're saying the housing market would probably crash?
Well, there's two arguments. So some people are saying if the government were not doing all the things it's already doing, remember, we've already put $75 billion towards refinancing and efforts to prevent foreclosures. So some people say if you weren't doing that, we'd be in a depression, that housing prices would have spiraled far more. But other people say, look, if the prices need to come down, let's take the pain now. Let's not delay it. And in fact, some people are concerned that the government programs are too risky. Even some people are calling the government the new Countrywide, which is probably a little extreme, but some people are saying that.
Okay. Louise Story, finance reporter for The New York Times.
They are countrywide.
The government. That's true.
That's true. They do have that advantage. They do have that going for them. Now, a takeout on sports, and joining us is Ibrahim Abdul-Mateen, Takeaway sports contributor. And, you know, we've talked about the NFL already this morning, but this is prime time for baseball. The big pennant race that Celeste and I have already discussed, and that we've actually discussed earlier this week, is the Twins versus the Detroit Tigers. The Detroit Tigers are two up on the Twins for the American League Central Division, and today is a big day. What happens today?
Well, today they play two games because yesterday's game got rained out. So if you're a Tigers fan and you're getting ready to watch your team, you get to watch them at 12 noon and at 7 p.m. And it features a great pitching duels and great pitching matchups. So it's going to be a really interesting day. If the Tigers can win three games out of the four games that they have to play against the Twins this week, then they will clinch. They will clinch their division. And that would be the first time since something like 1986 that they would have clinched the division. They've made the playoffs. They've been in the playoffs. But this will be clinching the division. On the other side, Minnesota has been playing great baseball. They've won 11 of their last 13 games.
They're hot right now.
Exactly. So they're one of the best teams right now in terms of momentum. So this is the playoffs right now for the Twins and the Tigers.
And who are the standouts? And I guess we're going to see Verlander pitching probably in this series at some point. But not today, right?
No, Verlander is pitching actually this evening.
He's in the second game.
Correct. Right. Yes.
Oh, fantastic.
They also have the Minnesota's got a guy named Rick Porcello, a young pitcher. He's a rookie. So there's a lot of interesting games. And then, of course, with the Detroit Tigers, I love Curtis Granderson. He's one of my favorite players in the league right now. He's a clutch hitter. So, and Miguel Cabrera on the Tigers as well. But then also you got Joe Maurer. And he is, for the Twins, he is one of the people that could, you know, he's vying for MVP title as well.
So Detroit could end its NFL losing streak and they clinch the AL Central division in the same week. Whoa.
And so that's actually a big point. Last night also another clinch happened in the AL, the AL West, the Los Angeles Angels of Anaheim. They won their division. And what they did, and just remember this, they had a player that died earlier in the season, a young pitcher named Nick Adenhart. And at the end of their game, they went out to the end of the field where his picture was, and they all kissed the picture of him on the field. So there was definitely a big moment for that team and for that stadium, for those fans as well.
And this is the second year in a row clinching the division for the Anaheim Angels, if I'm not mistaken.
It's the third year.
They've
won it in the last 5 out of 6 games.
So they are someone to be reckoned with.
Can I just take a moment and say that when I was growing up, the Anaheim Angels were such a weak team that I used to get 2 tickets to Angels games every time I got on the honor roll.
But those were the days of Rod Carew, right? At the Angels, yeah?
So the last thing I want to talk about is the NL side. The Atlanta Braves, literally a couple weeks ago, they were nowhere in the picture. No one was talking about the Atlanta Braves. Well, if you're an Atlanta fan, your team has played amazing baseball behind a young pitcher named Jarred Jurens, who's been literally lights out. His ERA is .85 in the last 4 games. He's been 4-0. And if the way you get into the playoffs and the way you play good baseball is with starting pitching. Right now, he's one of the hottest starting pitchers in baseball, and they are 2 games out of the wild card.
Of the wild card in the National League.
Correct.
After the Rockies, right?
Correct.
Colorado Rockies.
And they have a weak schedule. They play Florida and 3 games with the Washington Nationals. So I'm calling the Atlanta Braves to win.
Maybe the Braves are rallying because Bobby Cox, the coach for the last 30 years, says he's going to retire next year.
That might actually be something there. Maybe he's getting them whipped up into shape. That's true.
Ibrahim Abdul-Mateen, Takeaway Sports contributor, watching the baseball playoff race.
Indeed. Good morning.
Thanks.
And now our last takeout comes from our listeners. We spoke yesterday about daughters who were perhaps in difficult relationships with their mothers and vice versa. And after we got off the air, Dolores from Oklahoma gave us a call at 877-8-MY-TAKE.
I am 75 years old, and my mother never told me yes, and she never told me no. And for 70 years, I tried to please her in everything. I did everything, and I never pleased her. And the last lucid time we talked to each other, she bawled me out that I hadn't hemmed a dress 15 years ago for her for my daughter's wedding, and she lived 200 miles from me.
Wow.
We also heard from Kathleen. Wow. She wrote on our site at thetakeaway.org, my mom moved in with us about 5.5 years ago. She has Alzheimer's. Our relationship wasn't easy growing up, but I appreciate her love and willingness to do whatever it took for us to make it. There are days when it wears on me, but I have to say I'm grateful for the chance to care for her. Within the Alzheimer's community, there's clear institutionalized understanding of respite care, not so with mothering. You're expected to do that job without any real support system.
That's a
really good point.
Yeah.
And aging has been a very strong theme in all the responses we got from you. Anne also wrote, my mother, who passed away at 80 recently, was self-absorbed and narcissistic to her dying day and looking for admirers, not love or relationship with her daughter. After many years of therapy and trying approaches to reach out to her, I've had to move on, though sadly, and be thankful I didn't repeat this pattern as a mother myself.
Wow.
Thank goodness.
Really touched a chord with that conversation yesterday. It's the candor of our listeners that makes me amazed.
It's very moving, isn't it? We're also talking today about clear and present dangers. Hopefully not your mother. We're asking you, what is your clear and present danger? What do you think it is?
This is Bruce from down east Maine, the other state of Maine, and it's absolutely the economy, because with all the changes that have been made in Washington, it seems that still there's nothing getting done.
What do you think is the priority right now? Tell us at 877-8-MY-TAKE or send us an email to mytake@thetakeaway.org. Those are your takeouts.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Celeste Headlee.
Good Good morning, everyone. Coming up, we'll talk about differences within the international intelligence community about the nuclear threat from Iran. Right now, here are some of the news stories we're following at 33 minutes after the hour. The Dow Jones Industrial Average is open and bouncing around mark that it was yesterday as markets are reacting to housing news, improvements in housing. Those were announced just this morning. There's more news from Iran out just a few minutes ago about its newly revealed nuclear enrichment plant. Iran says it put the facility deep inside a mountain to protect its nuclear program in case of attack. It has long held its nuclear program is for peaceful energy purposes only, but nuclear watchdogs say the placement and layout of the plant doesn't support that claim. The president will discuss the mission in Afghanistan with NATO's new chief today at the White House. This is 30 civilians in southern Afghanistan are dead after their bus hit a roadside bomb.
Today, the Senate Finance Committee debates Democratic plans to add a so-called public option to the health care reform bill. Max Baucus's bill does not have that option now. Poverty is on the rise as the gap between rich and poor continues to grow. New census figures show poverty at an 11-year high. Income is down for all Americans. Those are some of the stories we're following this morning.
So continuing on Iran, you might have thought last week when the leaders of France and Britain and the United States gathered before reporters and disclosed this previously undisclosed nuclear enrichment facility in Iran, that there was a lot of unanimity about how to approach Iran regarding its nuclear ambitions. Here's British Prime Minister Gordon Brown speaking at the G20 meetings in Pittsburgh.
The level of deception by the Iranian government and the scale of what we believe is the breach of international commitments will shock and anger the whole international community, and it will harden our resolve.
It may be hard to harden that resolve if there are disagreements over the threat from Iran in nuclear terms. Joining us now is Mark Mazzetti, national security correspondent for our partner, The New York Times. Mark, it appears that the leaders may have a sense of agreement on how to take a hard line or how to approach Iran in advance of the Geneva meetings on Thursday. But the intelligence communities around the world have very different views of the status of the nuclear program in Iran, and that's what you're writing about. Describe the differences.
Well, as you said, there's a lot of unanimity on some aspects of the program. For instance, everyone was in agreement that Iran was trying to do uranium enrichment at this secret location that was exposed last week. Pretty much everyone's on the same page there. Where there's disagreement is on another aspect of Iran's alleged nuclear program, which is whether they're designing a warhead, really the so-called weaponization program.
Well,
you may remember that a couple years ago, the United States intelligence community came out and publicly said Iran had halted the weaponization in 2003. U.S. still believes that halt is still in place, whereas some of their European and Israeli partners believe that they're proceeding apace.
Now, if we understand the nuclear cycle, as it's called, you have to enrich uranium to have any chance of using it in a weapon, but you can't simply enrich uranium. You have to do other things. What are the triggers which say unmistakably to intelligence officials that weaponization is taking place, and why would there be disagreement?
Well, it's hard to really gather intelligence about this. You can do weaponization work in greater secrecy than you can enrichment. In other words, enrichment is a bigger process, one where it's harder to conceal. Therefore, it's one where it's easier for spy agencies to kind of get on the same page to share intelligence. It is more difficult to get a sense of whether they're doing this design work, where it's being done, in what locations, military or civilian around the country, or whether Iran is just intending to buy a kind of off the shelf weapons design from another country that already has nuclear weapons.
Well, let's take the off the shelf issue. Let's take the off the shelf issue off the table for just a moment and get to it before the end of the segment. But the whole process of enriching uranium actually lends itself to secret weaponization because you're using a giant centrifuge-based factory to take huge amounts of mined uranium and turning it into extremely tiny amounts of enriched uranium, which can be concealed. Why do the Israelis and the Germans, for instance, believe that weaponization is taking place? Is it technological intelligence or something that they were told?
Well, it's still a little bit unclear about why these countries are taking this position. The Israelis, according to officials we've spoken to, believe that weapons work resumed in 2005. They believe on the direct order of Iran's supreme leader. Now, when the American intelligence officials press them on this, at least according to Americans, they say the Israelis don't have really hard documentary evidence to prove that this work continued in 2005. It would have to be a sort of a memo or some kind of letter or some kind of internal communications. This is what they're trying to sift out now. The Germans, according to some publicly released documents last year, believe the work never halted. So it's as I said, a difficult sort of intelligence puzzle, whereas on the enrichment side, as you said, this is something that there's a technological process. You have to turn low-enriched uranium into high-enriched uranium, and this is something that is to some extent easier to spot.
Well, we spoke with your colleague David Sanger, who's on the byline in your piece this morning in the New York Times, and you know, we talked a little bit about what's likely to come up on Thursday. Is there any way for the leaders of the G5 to project anonymity on this question of weaponization, or do they simply say to the Iranians, prove to us you are not weaponizing on Thursday?
Well, I think that they may even try to mask over any differences they have and present a united front, because as we saw last week, there is a lot they agree on. And I mean, many nuclear experts will tell you the hardest part of any nuclear program is enriching uranium. That is, you know, 80 to 90% of the whole matter. So if everyone agrees that Iran is secretly trying to enrich uranium, presumably for some kind of weapons purpose, then everyone can agree and sort of hit Iran with that. And as we saw last week, they intend to use this sort of as a diplomatic cudgel to sort of get Iran to, in their view, come clean on other things that Iran's been hiding.
Now, on the Israeli question for just a moment, the Iranians claim that the Israelis would take preemptive action and are presumably firing these missiles as a way of saying, don't attack us. But there is precedent. I mean, the Israelis attacked the Iraq Osirik reactor back in the 1980s preemptively when some sort of threshold of weaponization was reached. Do we know what that threshold...
Yeah, and they also attacked a Syrian reactor.
Right. That was much more recently.
Right.
So what's the trigger for the Israelis? Do we know?
It's hard to know. I mean, I think that the Israelis are certainly, I mean, the Obama administration does not think this is a bluff on the Israelis' part just to apply pressure. I mean, I think that Israel has shown that they are serious about this. Now, what ultimately would be the trigger? It's unclear. One interesting side issue from last week's events is, you know, if President Obama, even in light of this, what they call duplicity on Iran's part, even in light of that, if President Obama can convince the Israelis, hey, we discovered the really big
right.
part of this secret program, and we've knocked it out, we've neutralized it, then maybe that buys the Obama administration more time for the Israelis.
Well, we'll have to see. One thing to watch. Mark Mazzetti, national security correspondent for our partner, the New York Times, talking about disagreements in the intelligence community on the Iranian nuclear program. This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry.
And I'm Celeste Headlee. So the WNBA Finals kick off in Arizona tonight. The Mercury is going to try and break through the very tough defense of the Indiana Fever. On the line from Phoenix is ESPN.com reporter Michelle Volpo. Good morning, Michelle.
Good morning.
And also with us in studio is Helen Wheelock. She's a fan from New York who wrote into The Takeaway asking us to cover the WNBA more.
Yeah.
Or at all.
Well,
you had a good point. You had a great point.
You put the scores out, which I appreciate, but I also feel like there are stories there that deserve your attention, and I really appreciate you saying, sure, let's do it.
So you're a courtside season ticket holder for mm-hmm. the New York Liberty. You know this league inside and out. So explain to me, number one, let's get your prediction quickly on who's gonna take it.
I think offense defeats defense, I think. Or then maybe not. So I'm going to waffle and cover my bases.
She's going to say either
who's
the Mercury or the Fever.
I think it certainly favors Phoenix. It's a up and down.
That would be the Mercury. Yeah.
Exhaust you offense. But Indy can be a real brick wall.
You're
so we'll see.
You're a long enduring New York fan. So explain to me what do you love so much about women's pro basketball? Why does this league deserve more attention?
I just think first of all, the passion of the game, the skill of the game, the way it engages fans, the kind of fans who attend it is just fun to be part of. And I think it reflects not only the future of athletics, but what's going on in society. So on a political way, great. But on basketball, it is great basketball.
So Michelle Vopel of ESPN.com, could actually be kind of an exciting year in the WNBA because the Detroit Shock and the Los Angeles Sparks have kind of had it locked up for a few years, but they both lost in the semis. Is there going to see a changing of the guard here?
Well, I think there's been, obviously, Phoenix won this title 2 years ago, so it won't be a new thing if Phoenix wins the championship, which, incidentally, I think is probably going to happen. But really, the breakthrough this year was Indiana making it through. Indiana lost 3 years in a row to Detroit in the Eastern Conference Finals. And so there's a new team, a new city, and obviously there's a very noteworthy thing happened in that Larry Bird, NBA legend, bought 7,000 tickets to get people in Indianapolis to come out to watch the Fever win their clinching game in the Eastern Conference Finals. So really thousands of people who wouldn't have been at that game were at that game. And Indianapolis sports columnist has suggested maybe this was the day when the Fever began to really matter to all of Indianapolis, and I think that was a pretty amazing thing that happened.
So, Michelle, this is my theory, and the crowds at WNBA games are very different from NBA games. My theory is that after a number of years, the fans of WNBA are starting to turn a corner, that we're starting to get a little less condescension, that people are starting to recognize that the game is played a little differently, but they're honoring the WNBA games as well. Quickly, Michelle, tell me, am I completely crazy or is that true?
No, I think that's true, and that's true of any endeavor that women have entered. You know, throughout history, there's initially condescension and scorn and roadblocks, and women have always proven they can do it if given a chance. And you're seeing the same thing in women's sports across the board.
Michelle Vopel from ESPN.com. We also are joined by Helen Wheelock, a fan of the New York Liberty. Better luck next year with the Liberty.
Yeah, heartbreaker being a Liberty fan. But two votes for the Phoenix.
Definitely.
You're listening to The Takeaway from Public Radio International and WNYC in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning, everyone. I'm John Hockenberry here with Celeste Headley. Can you tell I'm smiling?
I can.
Because Stephen Dubner rejoins us. He's the co-author of Freakonomics, and we'll ask him about his sequel.
Super Freakonomics.
Pretty catchy name, huh? More on that in just a moment. We're also talking about the biggest clear and present danger to the United States. What is the threat to the United States? Is it Iran, Al-Qaeda, the economy, healthcare? What should the priority of our nation be?
I think healthcare is one of the biggest things facing this country right now. I believe that the insurance costs are far too high for even the average person to afford. Middle-class people can't afford health insurance. I mean, they're regular, but they were hard-working people. They deserve some type of help.
Tell us at 8778-MY-TAKE. You know how to reach us at mytake@thetakeaway.org. And right now, here are some of the news stories we're following at 48 minutes after the hour. New numbers out this hour, show home prices up for the sixth month in a row. The Case-Shiller Home Price Index also says prices are down a third from their 2006 peak. There's a lag in the survey. Those numbers measure July. Next hour, the latest consumer confidence numbers. Iran says it buried a secret nuclear facility in a mountain because it feared attack. Iran has long claimed its nuclear enrichment activity is about energy, not weapons.
The Colorado man suspected in an alleged bomb plot is in New York court later this morning. Investigators say he planned an attack with homemade bombs. Two U.S. troops are dead after a roadside blast in the Philippines today. Al-Qaeda-linked militants are blamed for it. Also in the Philippines, hundreds are dead after a typhoon flooded the capital. The head of the World Food Program there tells The Takeaway that 600,000 people are now stuck in shelters. Those are some of the news stories we're following this morning.
Ooh, Freakonomics.
Now freak.
Ah, yes, the familiar sound. We welcome back to the studio now our good friend Stephen Dubner, co-author of the Freakonomics books and blog, and we'll soon be able to read why we haven't heard from Stephen in a while, and that is Super Freakonomics, Global Cooling, Patriotic Prostitutes, and Why Suicide Bombers Should Buy Life Insurance. That's your new book out in about 3 weeks. Can that's you, what you've been working on?
You sound pretty dismissive, yeah, but that's the result of that's all you could come up with after 4.5 years in a corkboard room. But yeah, that's true.
4.5 years. Well, you were on the program last on February 24th. Okay.
Wow.
The economy has pretty much been going straight up.
Told you
since
so.
Then. Yeah. I mean, I'm just figuring.
Oh, you're blaming it on my
well,
absence.
I'm yeah. trying to do the Freakonomics thing myself and try to understand what's going on in the world.
Well, if that's the case, then you certainly shouldn't have had me back today. If you
oh,
wanted to true. Keep going.
I know. Things are going to take a dive.
By the way, Stephen Dubner, Celeste Headlee.
Hi, Celeste.
Hello.
She was
nice
not
to
here
you.
When you were here
nice
last.
To meet you too.
I hear
lots
you sing.
I do.
Yeah, I'd like
I
to
do.
Hear that. Can we...
Not in this segment.
All right.
Not in this segment. No, because we invited you here on the program to talk about a story that is in your new book, but in some ways reminds people of the sort of Freakonomic approach to how you solve problems and figure out what's really going on as opposed to what the conventional wisdom suggests is going on. And it's a story from the 19th century.
Exactly. A young doctor in Vienna named Ignaz Semmelweis, whose name really should be known to all of us the way that, you know, I don't know about a George Washington, at least a George Washington
Why?
Carver. He was a pioneer and a smart guy who has saved millions of lives.
Millions.
Maybe, yeah, millions.
Easily millions.
And the way he did it was by figuring out why women were dying in this maternity hospital in Vienna, which was one of the best hospitals of the day. There was a death rate.
And
of
it wasn't
one
just one maternity hospital. This was a common problem in what period are we talking about?
This was in the 1840s, but okay. It predated that for decades, maybe centuries. It was called puerperal fever, childbed fever. And even in the best hospitals in the world like his, as many as 1 in 6 women would die after giving birth to a child. And frankly, the doctors of the day... Medicine was obviously not as advanced as it is today. Medicine doctors thought they were considered themselves fairly omnipotent. They had all kinds of reasons why this fever raged. But truth be told, they didn't know.
They would deliver the baby.
Healthy women would come to a hospital, deliver a baby, and die.
Get a fever and die.
Exactly. Now, interestingly, there were all kinds of confounding circumstances. The doctors blamed things like they thought the women wore petticoats too tight. Okay, they thought the women got up from the beds too soon after giving birth. They blamed the women, basically. All male doctors at the time, they blamed the women. He said, let's try to figure out what's actually going on.
There was also a theory I noted in the story that modesty had something to do with it.
Yeah, there was the idea that women in a position to have their privates exposed
right.
to male doctors just couldn't handle it and died on the spot.
They died
exactly.
of embarrassment.
I'd rather die than
yes, cue
you.
The fainting soprano, please, right. So he said, you know what, even if any of these are true, we're not improving it. So let's use the numbers to try to solve the mystery. And that's what he did. There was a very strange situation there. There were two wards, a ward where male doctors delivered babies and a ward where female midwives delivered babies because, again, women were not allowed to become doctors. He began to look at the death rates in the two wards and found that the doctor's ward death rate was 2 or 3 times higher than the midwife's wards. So you say, okay, maybe it is the presence of men. But
the embarrassment theory.
Perhaps, but he began, then he said, well, the babies often die too. And the babies aren't dying
they
anymore.
They can't be embarrassed.
They
right.
can't
right.
be embarrassed,
right.
precisely. So he began to back it up. And what he found was that the male doctors, were coming to the delivery ward from the autopsy ward. The autopsy was a fairly new practice of the day, and it was a miraculous way to understand how the body worked. The problem was hand washing was not a particularly advanced practice at that time. If at best, you might dip your hands into the same bucket of cold water that the guy before you had dipped his hands into. Semmelweis realized after a beloved mentor of his died after an autopsy getting accidentally sliced on the finger that maybe the cadaverous particles, in other words, the thing that killed the person who's having the autopsy, may be getting passed along on the hands of the doctors who then go to deliver the women.
So the fever of the guy who died in the autopsy room was similar to what happened to the women.
Whatever killed that person, it was basically, remember, this is pre-germ
yeah,
theory.
We didn't know
what germs were, and he kind of figured it out. He proposed a solution, chlorinated wash, put a little chloride of lime in the water, have the doctors vigorously scrub their hands. Within a week after doing this, the death rate at that hospital plunged to near zero.
Wow.
Now, the problem is people still don't wash their hands very, very often and very well, particularly doctors, even in modern hospitals, where the death rate from bacterial infections is shockingly high.
But I would think that if you're in a room with dead bodies and you're reaching around, that it would occur to you to
you
wash
would think
your hands.
That,
well, we no
you
longer
in...
have the same doctor doing the autopsy that then steps into the maternity
ward. That's true. We've got that going for us.
You would think that because you live in 2009. If you lived in 1847, it wasn't really what you thought about. Blood, the idea, you know, again, these are doctors who are blaming women for getting the disease on wearing petticoats too tight.
Freakonomics.
So, this is one of the stories in your new book, which is out in 3 weeks, Super Freakonomics, Global Cooling, Patriotic Prostitutes, Why Suicide Bombers Should Buy Life Insurance. Yes. Now, how have you...
Plainly, I should have called you for advice
before. No. I'm loving it. I'm totally loving it. Aside from the trauma of writing this book, which we've heard about, you know, stuck in a room, working on a book, and I've been there, you know, it's tough. How has sort of the Freakonomics strategy informed your sort of observations of what's been going on since you've not been on the show?
Like, well,
the economy has gone up and down.
I mean, we've talked about this a little bit when I've been here to talk about the economy. People respond very badly to emotion. Obviously, we need emotion to survive in life. But, you know, if there's a benefit to what we do with Freakonomics, it's that on the downside, you could say, these guys just take numbers, essentially. And we use numbers. We use the power of aggregated data to try to make conclusions about life. And we reduce life to kind of what the typical person would do in this situation. And a lot of people could say, well, that's kind of horrible because I'm not a typical person. You know, they say that if you add up all the adult men and women in the world, on average, they all have one testicle and one breast. But most people we know do not have that. So on average, it's not very helpful. But what we try to do is use the numbers to figure out what is average or what's typical. What you find is that anomalies work their ways into the news and then into our minds very aggressively, and they lodge there. Then we base our thinking going forward on these anomalous conclusions, like a stock market meltdown. So then we think that the world is coming to an end and so on. So I think
emotion gets in the way.
Emotion gets in the way. We need it. We use it way too much when we try to make rational decisions. I'm not saying we should throw it out, but
you're blaming the media. We cover these
not the media generally,
stories.
Specifically this show.
Okay.
Right. I see.
Well, I've only been here for like a week and a couple
so
days.
It's
I think
John.
It's John.
I'm blaming John. You're
that's right. Emotional wreck on the show. Getting in the way of everything. Stephen Dubner, I just want to say congratulations on the new book.
Thank you.
With your co-author. And welcome back.
Thanks very much.
Super Freakonomics.
It's a catchy title. Super Freakonomics. We've already updated that for you. Again, Stephen Dubner, author of the Freakonomics book and blog. Don't forget the blog. His new book, Super Freakonomics, is out in about 3 weeks.
So Iran is testing long-range missiles, Congress debating the fate of healthcare reform and the public option. What do you think is the biggest clear and present danger to the United States?
In my opinion, the enemy is within. We are doing a lot of things to create problems for ourselves in terms of our economy, government spending, fear and greed of the citizenry. So the enemy is within. We need to straighten ourselves out internally, and then I think we'll see better days.
Let us know what you think at 877-8-MY-TAKE or send us an email to mytake@thetakeaway.org. And, of course, if you've missed anything, you can always go to thetakeaway.org and subscribe to our podcast.
I'm John Hockenberry.
I'm Celeste Headlee. This is The Takeaway.
You know, you can catch the show live Monday through Friday. Thanks for listening. If you have any feedback or think there's any stories we should be covering on The Takeaway, contact us at 1-877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake@thetakeaway.org. See ya.